I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings,
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. So if you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link to become a Patreon sponsor in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding. We also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we do not have any guests, but we are going to dive into the magazine archives and read some old magazines. I just realized this is the 50th anniversary of the 1974 Mr. Olympia, one of the greatest Mr. Olympias ever. This was Arnold Schwarzenegger's, probably his finest condition ever in his competitive career. It was his fifth Mr. Olympia win. It was held at the Felt Forum at Madison Square Garden. And it was four competitors in the contest. It was Arnold up against Lou Ferrigno for the first time. Lou was a two-time Mr. Universe winner, and he was competing against Arnold. And also Frank Zane and Franco Colombo faced off in the newly created under 200-pound class. This was the first year that they had an under 200 and over 200-pound class. And Franco beat Frank Zane, and they were both in fantastic condition. So the reason I brought it up was I was looking through some of my old magazines and I came across this issue of Sports Illustrated magazine. I don't know if you guys have ever read this, but it was really a fantastic article on bodybuilding. It came from the October 14th, 1974 issue of Sports Illustrated, which at the time was the premier sports magazine in the world. It was a huge magazine. So for them to do an article on bodybuilding was really groundbreaking for the sport of bodybuilding. This, I believe, was about 2 weeks before the Mr. Olympia contest took place. I'm sorry, I take it back. I think it was that week when the magazine came out. Later that week was the Mr. Olympia. And then they did a follow-up article on the 1974 Mr. Olympia. So they were in attendance at that contest. So I want to read both of these articles. They both appeared in Sports Illustrated. And the first one is called The Men and the Myth. And it was written by Richard W. Johnston, who was an old-time writer for Sports Illustrated, but really, really great stuff, and it really predicted the rise of bodybuilding. And this was also right around the time that the book Pumping Iron was released. So a lot of great stuff was happening in the sport of bodybuilding at that time. It makes you a little nostalgic for those great days. Also, after that, I'm going to read a couple of articles about Serge Nubre. Serge Nubre died in 2011 on April 19th, so just this month. He's been passed away now for 13 years, if you can believe it. Serge was born in 1938, and he died at 72 years old. So there was a couple of really good articles on Serge from some of the Muscle Mag annuals that I have. One was from 1976, and the other one, I believe, was from 1977. So I'm going to read both of them, and it really goes into a lot of his training and nutrition as well. So I think you guys will enjoy that. People are always asking me about nutrition and workout articles about Serge Nubre. We're going to read about those articles in a second. Last weekend, I was out in St. Petersburg, Florida, and I was in attendance at the George Farah new documentary called The Guru, which I believe will be on Amazon Prime shortly, if it's not on there now. And it was a very well-done documentary about George's life, and particularly his struggles with cancer. And also, for those of you who don't know, George was shot back in 1997 when he was competing in bodybuilding and trying to make it to be a professional bodybuilder. He was watching a dice game, I believe, somewhere in New York, and some guy came up and robbed the dice game and shot him three times, shot him in the stomach. He came back from that, scars and all, and got his pro card by winning the middleweight class at the MPC Nationals, and then went on to compete as a professional bodybuilder and even competed in the Mr. Olympia a couple of times. So I went out there with Sean Ray. Sean was invited, so he came in. He flew in from California to attend. And Kai Green was there, and Dexter Jackson, and a couple other bodybuilding legends were in attendance. A lot of people were in the video, and they did a really good job of putting the video together. The way it was edited, it went really fast. And the whole story of George fighting cancer, because George got cancer a couple of years ago. I believe it was stage four cancer. He had to go through like 12 surgeries. So it just goes to show you the heart and soul of George Farah, man. What a fighter. He really fought back from all of these setbacks, especially the cancer, and he's doing good now. So it's a very good experience. I'm glad I got to see the movie and see George. I used to work with George back at Optum Nutrition probably like 15 years ago when we both worked there when I was still living in Chicago. So great to see George doing good, and I'm so glad he got through that cancer battle. Another funny thing that happened was I saw on Facebook that Albert Beckles had passed away. Somebody did a little post about Albert Beckles and posted some pictures of him, and he mentioned that Albert passed away in November of 2022. And I don't remember hearing that. So Roy Callender reached out to me right away after he read it, and he asked me if that was true. And then Rick Wayne also asked me if it was true, and I told him I didn't think it was. And they didn't think it was either. So when I was in the car with Sean, I picked him up from the airport. We were driving up to St. Pete from Tampa. I mentioned it to Sean that they said Albert had died on Facebook. And Sean pulled out his phone. He said, "Well, let's give him a call." So he called him, and Albert happily answered the phone. So Albert Beckles has not passed away. And he was laughing about the post on Facebook also. He said somebody said he had died. Albert is alive and well. So I contacted Roy and I contacted Rick Wayne and let them know as well. And Roy was very happy to hear that. Albert was Roy's idol when Roy first got into bodybuilding. They're both from Barbados. And he said Albert was the man back then. And Albert was the one who really inspired Roy to get into bodybuilding. So they've been old friends way back in the 50s and 60s. So that was great stuff. All right, what else is going on? Did get one email from Jarrett Hulse, who is one of our Patreon sponsors. So thank you for contacting me, Jarrett. Jarrett said, "Hey, John, I just wanted to tell you I really enjoyed your last episode in which you read articles related to the older lifters. It was a lot of fun to listen to. During the episode, you mentioned you've never seen Grimmick pose before and you would be curious to see it. There has been footage of Grimmick posing during a Mr. America contest in collectors' hands for many years now. I see that Carlos over at his Golden Era Bookworm YouTube channel has posted it online. I don't remember if it's from 1940 or 41 contest, because John Grimmick won the Mr. America two times. He's the only person to win Mr. America two times. He won it in 1940 and 41, and then they created the new rule saying that nobody could win the Mr. America title more than once. They were afraid Grimmick was going to go on winning it for several years. And he said, "A few years back, my friend David found some lost footage of Grimmick, Steve Stanko, George Eiferman, Steve Reeves, and others posing. David had it digitized and shared it freely on the internet. The image looks just like a hair squish to me, so some of the proportions are off, but it's still some of the best footage of that era. Grimmick even lifts a car into a parking space, kind of like Franco in Pumping Iron. It's a great video. I think you'll enjoy them." All right. Thank you, Jarrett. So Jarrett shared those two YouTube clips with me. So I'll put them on the description of this episode below so you guys can all check that out as well. So thank you, Jarrett, for sending that out. All right. So that's all I got for our opening, guys. Let's get into these articles that I want to share with you. And like I said, the first one I'm going to read is about the 19... Well, it's actually just about bodybuilding. And it was, like I said, a groundbreaking article that came from Sports Illustrated magazine, which if you weren't around back then, you don't understand. But Sports Illustrated was a huge magazine. All the magazines were big back then. Time magazine, Newsweek magazine, Life magazine. But Sports Illustrated was the sports journal. Aside from the daily newspaper, Sports Illustrated was like the big deal. So if you made the cover of Sports Illustrated, that was a huge thing. And just to be in covered in the magazine, of course, they covered all the major sports, but for them to cover bodybuilding was a major thing. So this was really interesting and kind of groundbreaking. So this came from the October 14th, 1974 issue of Sports Illustrated, and it's called The Men and the Myth. "For years, bodybuilding has been the victim of calumny and sniggering rumor, an embarrassment to its practitioners and few devotees. But today's master builder, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is pumping up enthusiasm for his sport." And it's written by Richard W. Johnston. About three blocks southwest of Respectability in downtown Los Angeles, a little bar called Lang's is lodged like a Formica pebble in one corner of the old Embassy Hotel. One evening last August, some of its patrons were discussing the long line of people ranging up Grand Avenue from the entrance doors of the Embassy Auditorium. "What's going on out there?" the bartender asked the middle-aged woman, whose angularity was emphasized by heavy horn-rimmed glasses. "I'll tell you what's going on out there," the woman replied. "It's those muscle men. You know, the men with the biggest muscles in the world. I wouldn't go see them for nothing. Not for nothing." As Lawrence Welk beamed down from the bar TV, the woman's escort favored her with an appreciative smile. "I'd kind of like to see him," he said, in a voice inviting further denunciation. "Forget it, honey," the lady said, clutching an arm that emerged like a bent chopstick from her friend's sports shirt. "Oh, are those guys going to hurt in 20 years? You just wait until they get old and their muscles get flabby. Oh, are they going to ache all over?" Lang's is a bar for regulars, for the disinherited, financially or physically. It is a comfortable Archie Bunker-type bar, where prejudices are welcome but not dissent. "Wonderful, wonderful," a salmon pink Lawrence Welk intoned. Outside in the deepening twilight, the crowd had begun to move into the auditorium, passing between posters proclaiming the greatest muscle show ever. Ranged below the red and black headline were silhouetted photos of six extravagantly distended figures: Arnold Schwarzenegger, 5 times Mr. Universe, 4 times Mr. Olympia; Franco Colombo, Mr. Universe, Mr. World; Frank Zane, Mr. America, Mr. Universe; Lou Ferrigno, Mr. America, Mr. Universe; Serge Nubre, Europe's greatest bodybuilding star; and Ken Waller, Mr. America, Mr. World. By the time the greatest muscle show ever began, there was no standing room left in the 2,100-seat auditorium. 200 people were turned away. In most ways, this was an unexceptional crowd, courteous and responsive, but also discriminating and critical. The racial mix was about what one would expect in a city as variegated as Los Angeles, and the income levels, as expressed by dress, seemed just as various. There were girls who obviously hoped to be mistaken for starlets, and men in well-tailored suits. There were lots of sports shirts, it was a sultry night, and hundreds of pantsuits. There were a few apparent homosexuals and a scattering of female groupies. Almost without exception, this was a crowd whose members knew how to look at what they were about to see. There was only one distinguishing thing about the group. It was the largest ever to see a bodybuilding contest in Los Angeles, though it numbered only 2,300 people from a metropolitan area of 7 million. The Little League in Inglewood draws more. This weekend in Madison Square Garden in New York, another small crowd, perhaps too small even to fill the 4,500-seat Felt Forum, will gather to see the superstar of the Embassy show, Arnold Schwarzenegger, defend for the 5th time a world championship, Mr. Olympia, that 99% of Americans have never even heard of. Just to be in the new garden and not the soiled old Embassy in Los Angeles or the Brooklyn Academy of Music is a leap forward for a sport that has languished for half a century in the subcellar of U.S. esteem. Those who do attend will see the exemplar of bodybuilding at the absolute peak of his powers. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the 27-year-old Austrian oak, may be the most extraordinary athlete anywhere today, as well as the most perfectly developed male in history. Yet on past form, it seems unlikely that local newspapers will even mention the event, although there's always the possibility that one of them will send a feature writer to deride, quote, the male beauty contest, unquote. For the voice of Lang's Bar is the voice of America, and not just blue-collar America. Americans unite routinely to denounce bodybuilders as narcissists, exhibitionists, degenerates, freaks. Although, like the lady in the bar, most have never seen one, and never will, not for nothing. The bodybuilder is at once said to be muscle-bound and the possessor of fictional muscles ballooned by drugs. He is both a cretin and a cunning egomaniac with evil intentions. Name your evil. To the considerable reassurance of the golfers and bowlers and round-the-clock TV football fans in their lives, women usually can be counted on to indict bodybuilders as grotesque. These demeaning stereotypes seem all the more curious in a society that in the last 20 years has elevated physical fitness to the level of a national concern. Bodybuilding is simply one of 3 branches of intense weight training, and there is no orchestrated denigration of the other two, Olympic and power weightlifting. The followers of all 3 disciplines, quote, pump iron, unquote, in the same gymnasiums and follow strict nutrition programs. Many other sports have for years relied on weight training to condition or rehabilitate participants. Some exercises are indeed highly approved if their purpose is to return a man to the kind of action in which he may again be ripped apart. Some of the derision can be traced to the Olympic and powerlifters themselves, whose specialties place no emphasis on symmetry of the body. Their distaste for bodybuilders dates from the 20s, but it was given the force of gospel after World War II by Alistair Murray, national coach of the British weightlifting team, who denounced building as muscular development without purpose. The Olympic lifter consoles himself with the notion that bodybuilders lack the speed and thick-waisted stability required by the two Olympic events, the snatch and the clean and jerk. The powerlifter, whose only goal is sheer strength, frequently cultivates a barrel belly, one he can bounce his knees as he posts 700 or 800 pounds from the floor in the deadlift. To him, a 34-inch waist under a 57-inch chest is a sign of weakness, and he pretends to have no respect for a man like Schwarzenegger, who has labored 12 years to achieve those precise dimensions. To thus sculpture his body, Schwarzenegger has pumped more iron than most power men could lift in two lifetimes. But so what? As one paunchy powerlifter said recently, what the hell do they do with all those muscles? I'll tell you what they do. They get up on a little velvet platform and pose. That's right, pose. La-di-da. Certainly one of bodybuilding's liabilities in the public mind is the fact that its achievements are demonstrated on the posing platform. The very word pose is a semantic disaster derived as it is from the French poseur, suggesting phoniness and nothing more strenuous than the languid lift of a monocle. It hardly describes the bodybuilder's act, which is about as la-di-da as a 100-yard kickoff return. In a maximum of 2 minutes, moving gracefully but dynamically from one position to another, a bodybuilder must demonstrate that he has developed and defined every imaginable muscle to its logical extreme for his height and skeletal structure, and has established a connection between each that creates an impression of perfect symmetry. As Schwarzenegger and other virtuosos perform it, posing is an athletic and artistic display that communicates as much emotion as a Bobby Thompson home run or a Joe Namath bomb thrown 60 arching yards 10 seconds before the final gun. The ideal, if less familiar, analogy is the fauna of a great matador as he moves a perfect bull through a series of linked natural passes. The olays crack the sky at such moments, and the embassy's crowd reaction to Arnold on the stand move from ovation to ovation, a phenomenon almost certain to be repeated at the forum. In the superb new book, Pumping Iron, to be published next month by Simon & Schuster, novelist Charles Gaines, the first writer to explicate the mystique of bodybuilding and firmly validate it as a legitimate sport, quotes Steve Mihalik, who was the AAU's Mr. America of 1972. When I'm up on that stage, I'm there by myself, me alone. I'm not up there with a baseball bat. I'm not up there with a football. I'm up there with just me, my body. It is this performance without props that seems the most difficult concept for the American public to grasp. It is, of course, a subjective performance. The poser is using his own body as a field in the same way that the figure skater uses ice or the diver air and water. And he will be judged in the same way, on form, grace, and skill. The totero can always blame the bull if he fails. The bodybuilder can only blame himself. The image that afflicts bodybuilding in the U.S. has not been fashioned entirely by uncomprehending or envious weightlifters, nor does it derive exclusively from the sport's unfortunate nomenclature. There is something more in the mix, and it is not very hard to identify. It dates from a 1920s idea that the male body, while perhaps the temple of the soul, deserved little respect and no glorification. The public attitude was set by the infant Time magazine, which hung a derisive tag on that early and much-aligned physical culturist, Bernard McFadden. Bernard Body Love McFadden, Time said, and said, and said, and said. It was not until the 1930s that exercise in general began to gain a little respectability, and in 1939, the AAU staged in its first Mr. America contest, being careful, of course, not to identify bodybuilding as a sport, a position that remains unchanged today. But it took the World War II draft and the physical deficiencies among the male population that revealed to jolt Americans into the notion that that exercise was really important. In the late 1940s, two brothers from Montreal, Ben and Joe Weider, challenged Bob Hoffman, whose York, Pennsylvania barbell company was virtually a monopoly and who financed and thus dominated the AAU weightlifting committee. The Weiders founded the International Federation of Bodybuilders. While Ben Weider was cajoling barons and dukes and prime ministers and rajahs into joining the new group, 87 countries now are members, and the General Assembly of International Sports Federations has recognized the IFBB as the official world governing body. Brother Joe moved to the U.S. and engaged in an all-out war with Hoffman. Although Joe Weider bills himself as the, quote, trainer of champions, unquote, and the discoverer of the Weider principles of weight training, his motives were by no means altruistic. En route to becoming millionaires, both Weider and Hoffman expanded their product lines to include hundreds of diet supplements, special exercisers, tanning oils, and magic lotions. Hoffman has never considered AAU bodybuilders as much more than an attractive nuisance. Attractive because they can be used to swell the gate at weightlifting contests. But he has no intention of relinquishing them to the Weider brothers. The Hoffman-Weider War, now a three-cornered affair with the rise of Dan Laurie of Brooklyn as a publisher and contest sponsor, has helped bodybuilding in some ways, but has hurt it in others. The partisans scream at each other in their respective muscle magazines, calling builders affiliated with the other entrepreneurs cowards and tricksters, and generally producing an abysmal level of trade journalism. Anyone leafing through these magazines is likely to find support for his worst suspicions of bodybuilding and bodybuilders. On an early September Sunday, Arnold Schwarzenegger, resting on the seventh day from a grueling week in which he had lifted, pushed, or pulled 240 tons of iron, drove down from his pleasant Santa Monica, California apartment to have brunch at a Marina del Rey waterside restaurant. He brought along his steady girl-next-door type friend, Barbara Outland, a tanned, honey-haired 26-year-old who teaches English and reading at Lincoln High School, a depressed area of Los Angeles. It was hard to believe that this was the same Schwarzenegger whose marvelously flexed and defined muscles had lifted the embassy crowd to roaring enthusiasm. Off the platform, his muscles relax and fall together. Only the wide shoulders and the expanse of biceps revealed by a short-sleeved sports shirt suggest Arnold's trade. A stranger might easily mistake him for an extremely fit football player. The thing Schwarzenegger cannot control, on stage or off, is that mysterious emanation Hollywood long ago labeled star quality. He seems to light up the posing platform, and at 10 a.m., fully dressed and anonymous, he lights up the restaurant. It is not just the bright blue eyes or the quick smile or the ready wit. Schwarzenegger simply looks delighted to be alive and to be Arnold. One feels that with a single appearance on U.S. television, all channels, he could alter the image of the sport. This morning, he addresses himself to some of the popular charges, including the claim that bodybuilding is not a sport, that it is development without purpose. Of course, bodybuilding is a competitive sport, he says. What is the purpose? To be the best, as in any other sport. What is the purpose for a sprinter whose goal is to do 100 yards in 9 flat? When you win a contest, you get back satisfaction for all the time you put in training. I also think that it's a good sport for everybody, even if one's only desire is to be fit. If you play tennis, you develop your right arm, not much else. But with bodybuilding, you make all your muscles grow. I also like it because it's a lonely sport. You go alone to the gym and figure out your problems alone. You are on your own. That's the one thing that impelled me. If I become great, it's because of me, not a coach. If your mind isn't ready for the sacrifice and discipline, no coach can do anything about it. And certainly bodybuilding is an art, as all sports are to a lesser or larger degree. You have to become an artist sooner or later, Schwarzenegger says. If you don't, you build your body wrong. If Michelangelo made a statue with the arms twice as big as the legs, you would have laughed at him. You have to be a really good eye to see, and the good taste to realize that, okay, your arms are too big for your calves. That's why bodybuilders look in mirrors, not because we're in love with ourselves, like they say, but to check the symmetry, to make sure all this enormous development makes a pleasing whole. So you can see that in bodybuilding, if you don't have an eye, that will be the end of it. Your own eye, however, is not always enough. Joe Weider is not my coach, Arnold says, but he has a good eye too. And sometimes he can spot changes that I have not noticed and maybe are not good. Also, Joe has found names for many exercises that had none. He calls these the Weider principles. and they help explain bodybuilding to young people. If he wants to call me his pupil, I do not mind. Joe has his own goals, though I do not agree with many of them. At this point, Barbara Outland interrupts the Oak. Arnold is the most goal-oriented person I've ever met. It takes so much knowledge to do what he has done, an understanding of anatomy, nutrition, your own body, and discipline and self-control. He's very practical. Whatever he does must be useful to him in some way, in the direction of whatever goal he has set. Most single-minded people are pretty grim about their objectives, but Schwarzenegger's saving grace is his perspective and sense of the ridiculous. Bodybuilding is a sport, he says, but it is just a sport. When I first came to this country, I went to see an AAU Mr. America contest. Would you believe it begins with a prayer? The prayer is asking God to help the judges pick the best body. Millions of people are starving in India. Thousands are dying in Vietnam, and these people are asking God to help them. I didn't know whether to fall down laughing or go outside and throw up. Schwarzenegger became involved in athletics as a schoolboy in a country village on the outskirts of Graz, Austria, a city of 225,000, where he was born on July 30, 1947. His father, Gustav, was a big man, a weightlifter, and a redoubtable curler. Until I was 10, I was a rather sickly child, Arnold recalls, but then suddenly I seemed to be well, and I realized I had a strong body. I was very interested in sports, and I decided then and there that someday I would be the best in some sport. His search for the right one to satisfy this resolve qualifies Schwarzenegger as a superb athlete. Perhaps unfairly, bodybuilders who have had no experience in other sports are not really considered athletes at all, even by other bodybuilders. I did not then know what would be the sport for me, Schwarzenegger says, so I tried various ones. I began with soccer, skiing, and swimming. When I was 12, I became a wing for the Graz Athletic Club, which was considered the second best team in the city. I did all the usual high school sports, boxing, curling, wrestling, and in track and field, the shot put and the javelin. But when I was 15, members of the soccer team began taking weight training to give us better legs, and I immediately liked that. I had reached my full height of 6'2", and I weighed 160 then. He weighs 240 now. In each sport, I asked myself, can I be the greatest? When I was told my reflexes were not quite fast enough to be a great boxer, I stopped doing that. The same with swimming, where I was also not as fast as others. When I was 17, I left the soccer team. I love soccer, but in a team sport, you must rely too much on others. I wanted to win or lose on my own. In 1965, when he turned 18, Schwarzenegger volunteered for the Austrian Army, and an intuitive commander gave him several hours off each day to work on Olympic weightlifting, a program Arnold had begun after abandoning soccer. That same year, I won the Austrian Junior Olympic Weightlifting Championship, he recalls, but I had begun to know that it would do more to hurt my body than build it. I had injuries, as all Olympic lifters do. My elbows, my shoulders, my knees. It's a dangerous sport. The human body is not made to do the Olympic lifts. I had been practicing bodybuilding too, working on all my muscles, not just the Olympic ones, and doing some powerlifting. That year, I went to Stuttgart, and I won the Junior Mr. Europe title. There, Schwarzenegger met a young Sardinian named Francesco Colombo. Colombo was at Stuttgart to compete in powerlifting, and he and Arnold, several years his junior, became best friends, as they still are. A more unlikely-looking combination is hard to imagine. The tall, merry Austrian, who apparently always has approached life with the disciplined mind of a Prussian general and a heart as light as a Strauss waltz, and the short, 5'5", enormously compact Sardinian, black-haired and smoky-eyed, but with lips frequently twitched by a puckish smile. Like Arnold, Franco was a certified athlete. He had ridden in horse races at home, and for a while he held the lightweight boxing championship of Italy. The year I went to Stuttgart, Arnold remembers, I won the Austrian and European curling championships, but I also realized there was no future in curling. I began going to the gym just to do powerlifting and bodybuilding. While he was still in the army, Arnold was offered a job running a gym in Munich, and after his discharge, he moved to the Bavarian capital, where Franco had settled. In 1966, they returned to Stuttgart. Franco won the middleweight powerlifting, and Arnold astonished everyone by winning the heavyweight division. He hoisted 710 pounds in the deadlift, 550 in the squat, and 485 in the bench press, for an aggregate of 1,745 pounds. Even today, the world record is only 2,005 pounds. Schwarzenegger also won the titles of Best Built Man in Europe. Later at Essen, he became Mr. Europe. And so finally, he had to choose between bodybuilding and powerlifting. It's possible to do both. Franco has done so, and he now claims the world light heavyweight record with an aggregate of 1,865 pounds. The amateur record is 1,680. He has also won the IFBB Mr. World and Mr. Universe titles, a remarkable achievement in a sport where great little men often lose to good big men. But Schwarzenegger felt he did not have the body structure, short arms, short legs, and a long torso to be the best in powerlifting. In 1966, his only loss in bodybuilding had been in the Mr. Universe competition in London, and in 1967, he went back and he won this highly prestigious event, at 20, the youngest man ever to do so. A year later, he repeated his victory. "That's when I first heard of Joe Weider," Arnold says. "He called and offered to bring me to the U.S. for the IFBB Mr. Universe contest in Florida. So I come and I go to Florida and I get beat by Frank Zane. I was disappointed, but Joe said, come to California and train for 1 year." Schwarzenegger had had a lot of fun in Munich, training hard, running his gym, chasing girls with Franco, and fighting in beer halls. "Munich's a crazy place," he said, "and the Germans are crazier still. Every day, every single day, I have a fight in Germany. In a bar, somebody hits you before you walk in the door. 20 or 30 people are fighting all the time. Nobody knows who you are or what they're fighting about. They fight until somebody gets knocked down. Then the loser gets up and buys the winner a beer, and everybody's friends. Like that. I was in the newspapers all the time in Munich because of my fighting. I was hardly known as a bodybuilder. Maybe because I never had to buy the first beer. It's still like that. I was there last year in the Oktoberfest, and everybody's still fighting." The year in California was beneficial. In 1969, after he won the IFBB Mr. Universe, Schwarzenegger felt he was ready to confront Sergio Oliva, a truly prodigious bodybuilder who even today has a loyal following that will not concede Schwarzenegger is the better man. In 1969, he wasn't. Oliva, defending his Mr. Olympia title, the Super Bowl of bodybuilding, for the third consecutive year, narrowly defeated Arnold. However, in 1970, Schwarzenegger defeated Oliva twice, once in the Mr. World contest and then in the Mr. Olympia. Arnold beat him a third time at the Mr. Olympia contest in Paris in 1971 and a fourth time at the 1972 Mr. Olympia contest in Essen. In fact, Schwarzenegger has never lost a contest to anyone since Oliva edged him in the 1969 Olympia. If the U.S. really has a boulevard of broken dreams, it is Pacific Avenue and Venice Beach, California. Although Venice Beach fronts on a great golden curve of sand, its canals are green with algae, and its small hotels and ramshackle cottages have gone to seed. Once a haven for retired middle-class Jews who had come to die by its strand, Venice Beach was overrun in the post-war years by successive waves of impoverished adults and then by the flower children celebrated by Lawrence Lipton in his book, The Holy Barbarians. Today, a few old people who have outlived their own expectations hide behind barred windows from the last outpourings of the 60s, used-up rebels, Jesus freaks, strung-out hippies, Satanists, ancient winos, and young pushers. It is a strange place to find a shrine dedicated to hard work, self-sacrifice, and physical fitness. But the shrine is there. A square box of a building only two stories high, its front emblazoned with red, white, and blue block letters that say Gold's Gym. Inside the gym is Spartan, one large two-story room, 40 by 65 feet, walls mirrored, the interior carpeted but cluttered with dozens of strange machines, some with overhead pulleys, some with long bars hinged to the floor at one end, others too complex to describe. Stacked along the walls under the mirrors are hundreds of the round iron discs that slide onto bars to make barbells of varying weights. Some weigh only 2.5 pounds, others weigh 45. At 9:30 a.m. on a recent smoggy Wednesday, a dozen or so people are doing various things with various weights. Two of them are among the all-time greats of bodybuilding, Frank Zane and Ken Waller. Zane is an algebra teacher at the local high school. His wife teaches art. While Waller, who was the captain of the Western Kentucky football team in 1965 and 66, and later played in the Canadian Pro League, is an instructor in physical education. His wife is a court reporter. "All the great Southern California bodybuilders train here," says Dan Howard, a former University of Tulsa middle linebacker and team trainer with a BA in biology who manages Gold's. Joel Gold started the gym about 8.5 years ago after Santa Monica closed down the old Muscle Beach. I wasn't around here then, but I guess that was a pretty bad scene. What with the girl groupies and the fags hanging around. All bodybuilders aren't Boy Scouts. Some of them were responding to those crowds in ways that didn't help the sport. Howard meets the obvious question without heat, although all bodybuilders are sick to death of it. I only know of three great bodybuilders in the history of the sport who were homosexuals, he says. There's a higher percentage of that in pro football. Sure, we get some in the gym. We have 250 members, but we don't exclude people because of their lifestyles. On the dot at 10 o'clock, the back door of the gym opens and Arnold Schwarzenegger comes in. There are only casual greetings for the man who has made Golds internationally famous, but somehow the atmosphere changes. Before he addresses his own Herculean chores, Arnold wanders around the gym. Suddenly, every workout becomes brisker and more purposeful. On Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, Schwarzenegger works on his arms, biceps, triceps, and forearms, his thighs, quadriceps, calves, gastrocnemius group, and his waist, the abdominals. On Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, he concentrates on his chest and back, pectoralis, trapezius, latissimus, and erector spinae, his shoulders, trapezius, and deltoids, and again, his waist and calves. When he's training for a contest, as he is now, Schwarzenegger splits his workouts, 2 hours in the morning, 1 hour in the late afternoon. The weights and repetitions involved stagger the imagination. Some of them include 10 sets of 10 reps each in the bench press, with the barbell load going up to 450 pounds. 100 squats with the load increasing to 500 pounds. 200 curls, 100 with each arm, with dumbbells weighing as much as 100 pounds. And a calf exercise done daily, in which Arnold goes up and down on his toes, lifting as much as 1,000 pounds of iron. 40 tons a day, 6 days a week. Is all this agony worth the moment of satisfaction that comes at the end of a successful contest? Well, it isn't all agony. There are immediate rewards. First comes the pain, Schwarzenegger says. As the weight gets heavier and the number of repetitions grow, the muscles begin to hurt. Here's where mind and character come in. Here's where you cannot stop if you want to be great. You must be able to tell the muscle to continue until you complete the exercise. You must gut it through. It is the painful part that makes the muscle grow. But then comes the reward. Then comes the pump. As Charles Gaines has written, the pump is the fix and rush of bodybuilding. This is the moment when the bodybuilder stands before the mirror and flexes the muscle and watches the great flow of oxygenated blood spread through it, visibly enlarging it, proving that the previous agonizing minutes have not been wasted. There is more than mental satisfaction in the pump. It's been compared to a feeling of sensual ecstasy or the great well-being that comes to a distance runner 2 or 3 miles into his event. Suddenly, something that has been a matter of great effort, perhaps even pain, is transformed into a sense of lightness and euphoria, a flush of joy that half convinces him he can run forever. Non-athletes often find it incomprehensible that people who have no chance for greatness will rise at dawn to run 5, 10, and even 20 miles, and that they actually seem to look forward to these ordeals. A pump is the answer. And it explains, too, why old bodybuilders never ache away as the lady at Lang's felt they would. They continue their workouts, in modified form, of course, not in desperation, but for pleasure. While most bodybuilders pump up backstage before posing appearances, that is, they do a few quick exercises to start the oxygenation of the blood, Schwarzenegger does not, except during competitions, and then only for insurance. Thanks to his extraordinary concentration and training, Arnold has achieved mental control over his bloodstream. He literally can command his biceps or his abdominals or his quadriceps or a whole group of muscles to engorge. And his biceps flex, for example, the size of the muscle will increase between 10 and 15%. The only parallel to this sort of mental control of the body's normally involuntary systems is provided by Kundalini Yoga, a discipline that takes more years to achieve than Arnold has been alive. If, as Barbara Outland says, Schwarzenegger is the most goal-oriented person she's ever met, what is left for him? Why is he training so hard for this week's Mr. Olympia contest, running 3 miles every other day in deep sand besides doing his 40 tons of weights, when a victory can only reassert what he's already proved? Is being Mr. Olympia 5 times all that much more important than 4? Sipping sangria while eating an omelet at the Brown Bagger in Marina Del Rey, after completing a morning workout, Arnold articulates his motivations. When I decide in Germany that in bodybuilding I can become the best, I also think it will last. It's something I can make money at, as well as prove myself. I have made quite a bit of money. Now I want to make more, but also do other things. Schwarzenegger's income now ranges between $40,000 and $60,000 a year, chiefly from endorsements, a mail-order instruction business, and posing exhibitions. Only he and Franco Colombo have been able to support themselves professionally in the sport, although many others have built on it with their own gymnasiums or health clubs. Schwarzenegger had no sooner won his first Mr. Olympia in 1970 than he began to look 5 and 10 years ahead. He had an instinct for business. Instead of swinging giddily with his newfound eminence, he enrolled at the UCLA School of Business Administration. Next spring, he will graduate, not from UCLA, but from Cal State, where he has transferred partly because that's where Barbara is getting her master's. Unlike many business school students, Schwarzenegger did not wait for graduation to get into the marketplace. 4 years ago, he started publishing booklets on conditioning and instruction in bodybuilding, both for beginners and advanced students, and this mail-order business has doubled in volume every year since. Defending the Mr. Olympia title is both a matter of pride and a matter of business. The title of Mr. Olympia is valuable, Schwarzenegger says. It means you are the best. Sergio might even enter, though I believe he's under suspension by the IFBB. If he's really serious about wanting a pose down, as he said recently, I will meet him any time if the AAU will sponsor the contest. But the Mr. Olympia, even without Sergio, could be a very serious affair because Lou Ferrigno will be there. Being on guard against Ferrigno is good business for Schwarzenegger. The 6'5" Ferrigno won both the AABA Mr. America and Mr. Universe contest last year at the age of 21. And at the embassy, he captured the Mr. International title. Bodybuilding contests actually are prejudged in the afternoon, without an audience and under bright lights that make it difficult to conceal any inadequacy. Instant tan solutions and the body oil that makes builders glow on the body posing platform at night are barred. The oil can be anything from Bain de Soleil to plain old Wesson. The points of judgment are symmetry, muscle density, and mass and presentation, or posing. The first two must be joined. The mightiest arm cannot overcome a scrawny calf. Only a profound and dramatic reversal of form will change votes at the public show, and even that will not avail if the only improvement is in posing. None of these things occurred at the embassy. 4 of the 11 judges voted for Ferrigno, the rest splitting their ballots among 4 other contestants. Although Franco Colombo is studying to be a chiropractor, his wife, Anita Santangelo, is a doctor of chiropractic orthopedics, he joined Schwarzenegger in promoting the embassy show. Like all IFBB contests, the Mr. Olympia accepted, it was an amateur event, which meant the pros, Arnold, Franco, Zane, Waller, and Nubray, appeared only as guest posers. Either Arnold or Franco could have beaten Ferrigno that night, at least in part because they were better cut up. That is bodybuilding jargon for defined, meaning that all fat or water has been stripped away so that each engorged muscle stands out in stark relief. This stripping is accomplished toward the end of a bodybuilder's training grind by increasing and speeding up repetitions in the gym. The worst thing you can call a competitive bodybuilder is smooth, i.e. undefined. In Los Angeles, Ferrigno looked relatively smooth, and his posing style was unattractive, but he was undeniably massive and he had good symmetry. If I had been a judge, I would have voted for him, even though he was not in shape, Arnold says. I would have asked myself, which body up there would I like to have? And I would have said Ferrigno's, because in 30 days I would mold it so that it might beat anybody in the world, including me. Although Schwarzenegger doubts that Ferrigno himself will be able to do that job, he can hardly afford to be wrong. So he's been training like an underdog, pumping extra tons of iron, increasing his protein intake through ordinary foods, and doubling up on vitamins. For the last 6 weeks, he's also taken orally 15 milligrams of Dianabol, an anabolic steroid, each day. Schwarzenegger says that steroids do not build muscle, but they may help sustain it while he's stripping down for definition. Actually, he says, I think they're virtually worthless, but everybody uses them before the contest, so I do too. Again, it's a matter of insurance. Schwarzenegger is genuinely and deeply concerned about bodybuilding's dreary image, particularly as it's projected by the trade press, including Weider's Muscle Builder and Power magazine, which has run thousands of pictures of Arnold, and which Arnold has tried to upgrade with occasional byline stories of his own. All of these magazines, Weeders, Hoffman's, Lorry's, I call them comic books, circus books, these headlines, how Arnold terrorized his thighs. Ha! This is Joe's biceps speaking. Why are Joe's biceps talking to anybody? It's not that much of a biceps. Joe exposes Lorry, and Lorry exposes Joe, and Hoffman's against everybody, and he can't tell Ben from Joe, or he says he can't. Why won't these guys get together? I'll tell you why. It's because none of these silly people are really interested in bodybuilding anymore. They're interested only in the money that can be made from it. Each of them says he's for bodybuilding, but these men are not. They are knocking the sport down. I asked Joe why he prints such junk. Why is everybody bombing and blasting and terrorizing? All these silly words. Joe says it sells the magazine, period. Arnold's ultimate goal is to publish his own magazine about the sport he loves. I'd like to get a hold of Joe's magazine, he says, but he will not give it up, such a sales manual. I'll have to start my own magazine, a real magazine, a bodybuilding magazine, not just something to sell products to 14-year-old boys. It'll be about the sport. Personal attacks will be out, totally out. If Joe wants to say he built all the champions and he trained 3 million bodybuilders, he'll have to do it in an ad, not in any article. The same with Hoffman or Lorry. I have no personal quarrel with any of them. I'll try to get them together. So maybe we'll have fewer contests, but real champions, not 3 Mr. Americas, 3 Mr. Worlds, 2 Mr. Universes. Then maybe the sport will have respect, like it has in other countries. In India, 40,000 people turned out to see Bill Pearl. I myself had an audience of 10,000 when I was a guest poser in South Africa. But here, when Franco and I got permission from Ben Weider to promote the Mr. International show at the Embassy Auditorium, I wanted to have it on TV, to sell it to TV. A guy I contacted said, yes, they were interested, you know, but first show us what bodybuilding is all about. All I had to show was Joe's magazine, and they looked at it, and then they were all laughing. They thought the show would be the same thing as the magazine. I'll call you, the guy says. Don't bother, I said. I was embarrassed. Can Arnold Schwarzenegger change bodybuilding's image in the U.S.? Perhaps. Frank Zane says Arnold is the first person who's ever been in the game who's been actively trying to promote it and give it a good name. There may be a clue in Arnold's own name. Schwarzenegger translates literally as black plowman. There's a lot of plowing under, that is, to be done if the next generation of builders is to grow and prosper. The end. Isn't that an awesome article? What a great article in a mass media magazine to the general public. Okay, now I guess Sports Illustrated did a follow-up article. They went to the Mr. Olympia that same weekend, and they reprinted the article in Muscle Builder magazine. It was in the March 1975 issue of Muscle Builder, which also covered the 1974 Mr. Olympia contest. And it says, Trying to Muscle In, and it's written by Barry McDermott, reprinted courtesy of Sports Illustrated. It says, Practice makes the perfect man. He's still Arnold Schwarzenegger. Even the sharpest perception is dulled by the maelstrom of New York City, a place where an extravaganza is as common as wingtips at the Rotary Club. But last week, many blasé New Yorkers were gagging on their sequins and denim cool, gaping like tykes at the circus at the sight of the huge men strutting about Madison Square Garden. The Giants were there for a showdown, not with fists or guns or even with basketballs, but with muscles. The occasion was the Mr. Olympia contest stage at the Garden's Felt Forum. It was a bodybuilding competition among the world's most muscular and best-developed men, and their talent was obvious. No bad call by an umpire, no upset stomach, no poor footing could induce a slack performance. It was all there on the posing stand. The symmetrical results sculpted through tedious, agonizing, and seemingly endless hours of pumping iron in dank gymnasiums. And it was appreciated by a coterie of zealous fans. The objects of esteem were four men at the zenith of their sport, athletes so far advanced that even their colleagues regard them with envy and awe. They were Arnold Schwarzenegger going for his fifth consecutive Mr. Olympia title, enough of a legend in his first name to evoke a response whenever a barbell is picked up with purpose. Lou Ferrigno from Brooklyn, even bigger than Arnold, but young, entered in his first professional contest. Franco Colombo, short and compact, whose misfortune it is to be performing in the same era as his friend Schwarzenegger. And Frank Zane, like Arnold and Franco, a Californian, also a school teacher, and one of the few ever to defeat Schwarzenegger. That victory was back in 1968 in a Mr. Universe contest. Ferrigno was the subject of speculation and curiosity, the rookie who looked good during the spring, but could he hack it in the major league? He's 6'5", weighs 265 pounds, and at 22 is regarded as the heir to the champion. The two had never met, and just a few days before the contest, Ferrigno wondered about the wisdom of challenging Schwarzenegger, the Austrian Oak. If Ferrigno did and lost, the appearance in the Garden would cost him his amateur status, and he would become a wandering minstrel with nowhere to play his tune. On Wednesday, Matthew Ferrigno, who was a lieutenant of the New York City Police Department and Lou's father, said, "If Arnold were here, we could decide, but Arnold don't show himself to nobody." The champ was still in Los Angeles. The next day, young Ferrigno appeared at a press preview, and after a session under the warm lights of the television cameras, the brooding giant made his decision. He would meet Schwarzenegger. "I've been waiting 8 years for this day to come," he said in a heavy Flatbush accent. "The Olympia is the most prestigious class in the world. If my son wins, he will hold the title for a decade," the lieutenant noted proudly. "There's nobody on the horizon to challenge him." The dark, bushy-haired Ferrigno, who for the moment has put aside his career as a sheet metal worker, had just won his second Mr. Universe title in Verona, Italy, and was on a six-hour-a-day, six-day-a-week training schedule and a strict diet. Criticisms of his legs were driving him to lift 600 pounds 15 to 20 times daily to improve his calf muscles. His detractors said he still lacked the definition of muscle essential to achieve top ranking in the sport. The ability was there, but the polish was missing. Ferrigno is massive, but so is Schwarzenegger, and the Oak's muscles jump out at you like an outrageous price tag. "Lou can't even beat me," said Colombo, his voice accented with scorn. "He lacks experience in a few body parts, like a back and calves. When he stands with Arnold, he looks bigger because he is bigger. He looks impressive. But when they pose, Arnold's experience wins out. An amateur will be up against a professional." Colombo was competing with Frank Zane in the small class of the Mr. Olympia, the category for men weighing less than 200 pounds. There would be individual class winners plus an overall champion, but it was obvious that Colombo considered the major title beyond his reach. Why then was he there? "The main thing is not to win the contest," he answered. "I have a very good following. They expect a good show." Just then, a skinny teenager walked up and plaintively asked the secret to gaining weight. It was like badgering Nolan Ryan about how to pitch a fastball. "I have a booklet about that," Colombo said. He peddles booklets explaining his training secrets. They sell for $2. Schwarzenegger gets $3 for his. On Friday, Colombo and Schwarzenegger appeared on a morning television show. Ferrigno was not there. "He's probably sitting at home watching my body and moving around his television set, posing to see if he should compete," said Schwarzenegger. "I want to go up against Ferrigno because he's new and people are talking about him." Both Schwarzenegger and Colombo are considering retirement. The Oak is only 27, but he's weary of competition, or perhaps the lack of it. And he hinted that this would be his last contest. Colombo, who claims to be 30, but he may be older, is attending a chiropractic school. He intends to go into business. When the competition began, it was immediately evident that Colombo would defeat Zane and win that class. Next to the dense, muscular Italian, Zane looked almost willowy. That left the champ and the challenger. The crowd responded with wild shouts of encouragement as Schwarzenegger and his young opponent took the stage. Spotlights and oil highlighted their muscles. As they moved through their poses, Schwarzenegger's superiority began to show. At one point, they turned and found themselves face to face, both locked in arm shots, veins popping and foreheads glistening, their bodies trembling with effort. Schwarzenegger looked at Ferrigno and smiled as if to say, "You are beaten." It was a boxer psyching his opponent, and the crowd knew it, and so did the judges. Once more, Arnold Schwarzenegger was Mr. Olympia. Later, as he walked down the crowded streets of the city, people turned and stared unabashedly at him. Tykes at the circus. All right. So kind of a shorter article, but another great article in Sports Illustrated. All right. That was great stuff. Okay, I got two articles here I want to read about Serge Dubré, the great legend Serge Dubré, who died, what was it, 13 years ago this month, in April of 2011. So these are both from Muscle Mag International. The first one was from Muscle Mag International 77, which covered all the competitions from 1976. So the magazine came out a year after all the competitions it covered. It was written by both Bill Reynolds and Denny, and I believe they took pictures as well of Serge. And this was when Serge was in New York training at Tom Minutiello's Mid-City Gym. It says, Serge Dubre is the new NABBA professional Mr. Universe. It is his first major international title, and yet Serge is widely recognized as one of the greatest bodybuilders of all time. Were it not for Arnold Schwarzenegger, Dubre might have already won the coveted Mr. Olympia contest, the Super Bowl of bodybuilding. We had two opportunities to talk with Serge Dubre during September 1976, at a time when he was only a week from the Mr. Universe title. We talked with him only hours before he unaccountably lost to a very smooth Sergio Oliva at the WBBG Mr. Olympus contest. Unlike many top men who would have ranted and raved at the loss, Dubre took the decision with consummate dignity. We had a second opportunity to talk with Serge Dubre the following day. He was winding down his training at Tom Minutiello's Mid-City Gym in New York. We watched him train and later took a taxi to Central Park for outdoor color and black and white photos. At 38 years of age, Serge Dubre has been competing periodically since the late 1950s. He feels he can train hard for another 5 years, a period during which he thinks he will become the best physique champion in the world. It would be difficult to find fault with Dubre's goal of becoming number one. To pick out a flaw in his physique is extremely difficult. His chest and shoulders are unequaled. His back, although he calls it a weak point, is superb. His arms, Serge's least favorite body part, are superior. His abdominals are slightly uneven on each side, but they are so sharply delineated as to cause gasps of amazement from anyone who sees Dubre tense his midsection. Even the formerly maligned Dubre legs are great from all angles. His small pelvis, trim waist, wide shoulders, and flaring lats give him an incredible V-shape. Dubre stands a shade under 5 feet 10 inches and weighs a fraction over 200 pounds in contest condition. We asked his measurements, but aside from his body weight, he takes none, preferring instead to let the mirror guide his training. Just as estimates, his arm must be between 19 and 19 and a half inches, chest over 50 inches, waist under 30 inches, thighs about 27 inches, and calves about 18 inches. On the personal side, Serge is president of the French Bodybuilding Federation, and he runs two modern health studios in Paris. Dubre also does a large amount of film work. He hopes soon to publish bodybuilding courses, but at the present, he feels that the lack of time will not permit this new venture. Dubre married soon after moving from his native Guadeloupe to Paris. He is divorced from his first wife, but has two boys of 13 and 10 with her. He remarried, and his second wife has presented them with a daughter, now 11 months old. Serge's wife attends the university, where she will soon receive a law degree. Like Serge, she is a physical culturist. Serge Dubre plans to tour the United States for a month in late August and early September of 1977. He will be giving posing exhibitions for a very reasonable fee. Anyone interested can contact Serge through Bill Reynolds. Serge Dubre speaks excellent English, so the following interview was a pleasure to do. He laughs a lot, and he has an excellent sense of humor. We decided to concentrate on how he prepares for a major show. Here are the words of Serge Dubre. Before we get into how you prepare for a contest, Serge, will you give the readers a general idea of how you usually train? What sets, reps, weights, how often? I train very much by feel, and I follow no set program. After nearly 20 years of steady training, I have developed a very good rapport with my body. It tells me how much to do and when each body part has had enough. But to answer your question, I train 7 days a week all year long. Generally, I allot 1 hour per body part, doing perhaps 35 to 45 sets during that time. Most body parts receive 3 workouts per week, but for weak parts like my back and calves, I'll do 5 or 6 workouts each week. I never count sets because when you know your body, you'll know when you've had enough. Do you use heavy weights? No. Although when I was younger, I did try to use large poundages. I do a large number of sets with relatively light weights, short rests, and high reps of 12 to 15. My workouts vary constantly since I do each day what my body tells me it needs. It's only with light weights that I can get a good pump and grow. Do you train differently between contests than just before? No, it is the same, except I do taper off the last week before a large competition. I always train the same, but my diet is very different prior to a contest. I must be very careful about the diet. What's the difference between your off-season diet and the one you usually follow before a contest? My usual diet is very much like that of an ordinary person, except that I eat very large quantities of everything. I eat all foods except sugar, butter, and oils. No cakes, but I do eat spaghetti, rice, and other carbohydrates. When on a diet, I cut out all the rice and all the carbohydrates. I eat only meat, fish, take vitamins, and drink water. What types of fish and what types of meat do you prefer? I like tuna fish and horse meat. Horse meat? Now, wait a minute. Big laugh from Serge. We don't eat horses here in America. Yes, I know that, but in Europe, we eat a lot of horse. It's very expensive there, and I prefer the taste to beef. In addition, horse meat is a bit leaner than beef. Do you eat any chicken or turkey? I don't eat too much chicken or other poultry for that matter. How much meat and fish per day do you eat? On an average, about 3 kilograms or 6.6 pounds. When I first started using a pre-contest diet, and for many years I never dieted, I ate about 5 kilos, 11 pounds per day. Now I find 5 kilos to be too much and I eat only 3. How long ago did you begin watching your diet? It was when I saw the German bodybuilder Karl Blumer at the Paris Mr. Universe contest in 1971. He was very defined at that contest, while before he had been relatively smooth every time I saw him. In only a year, he went from being fat to being unbelievably cut up. He was one of my friends, and naturally I was very curious, so I asked him the secret. Karl told me what to do, and it turned out he had been on the diet that I now follow prior to a contest. Meat, fish, water, and vitamin and mineral supplements. We noticed a few minutes ago that when Franklin Green offered you a protein drink, you refused it. Don't you take protein supplements? I definitely do take a protein supplement mixed with liquid. The reason I did not want it just then is that I will be eating in a few minutes. When you take in a liquid protein before eating solid food like fish or meat, you can eat less of the solid food. You can, on the other hand, always seem to drink a little more when you're full of meat. So it's after my meals that I'll usually take a liquid protein supplement. Do you prefer to eat the meat and fish or the same number of grams of liquid protein? I prefer the meat. Protein supplements should be used as supplements and not as the main source of food. What vitamins and minerals do you take? My diet includes all the vitamins and minerals, but it's heaviest in the B complex group, B1, B6, B12, vitamin E, and vitamin C. Because of the lack of fruits and vegetables in my pre-contest diet, I take more vitamins and minerals in supplement form when preparing for a show. Many American bodybuilders take desiccated liver. Do you use this supplement? No, because in France, it's very difficult to obtain a liver supplement. And do you take kelp? No. Having traveled around the world, Serge, where do you find the best food? Oh, in Guadeloupe, my homeland. I'm sure for you, it would be in America. In Guadeloupe, it's very much a fruit diet, isn't it? Yes, up to a point, but in Guadeloupe, we have very fresh fish and very fresh meat. They cook with a lot of seasoning, so the taste is very good in addition to the high nutritional value. You eat very large quantities of food, and yet you always seem to be very muscular. How would you describe your metabolism? I don't have any trouble losing fat, so I would say it's very good. Indeed, I never become very smooth, regardless of what I eat. Because I guest pose at a number of shows throughout the year, this is an advantage. I tend to look good in the off-season, but not as good as I want to for a competition. What do you weigh at a contest as opposed to between contests? About 96 or 97 kilos, 212 to 214 and a half pounds when I'm not in a contest, and 91 or 92 kilos, 200 to 202 pounds for a competition. Of all the countries in which you have posed, where did you receive the greatest reception? Well, I think you'll find this strange, but it was in South Africa. South Africa? Yes, in Johannesburg, where there is now all the racial turmoil. I had 20,000 people come and see me. The ovation was unforgettable. About how much time each day do you practice posing in preparation for a competition or exhibition? I seldom practice posing because it's somewhat of a natural talent for me and I give a large number of shows. I do individual poses occasionally to check my condition, but the sequences are seldom done. How do you develop your posing routine? It just gradually evolved. I do, as I said, a number of shows in Europe, maybe more than 25 per year. Being in so many times in front of the public, I've become used to an audience, and my posing routine has gotten smoother and more dramatic with time. When you were developing your routine, did you copy the poses of any famous bodybuilders that you admired? No, I don't think I really copied anyone's poses because bodybuilders have different types of physiques. I have evolved poses that agree with my own particular body. Thus, I do many poses with my hands down at my sides. Although I can do a double bicep pose, it's not included in my routine. Almost everyone does this pose, as you know, but it's not as good for me as other poses, and I must always strive to look my best. In your opinion, what's the most ugly pose used by bodybuilders in competition? Oh, the most muscular pose, without question. Unfortunately, however, you have to do it. If you don't, people today are not satisfied. And what's the most beautiful pose? There are many. One needs only look at the artworks of the great masters, Michelangelo, Rodin, and others. Unfortunately, such poses are not well suited for competitions. We remember seeing photographs of you competing in the Mr. Universe contest in Montreal in 1959. You did several very graceful poses with your arms stretched overhead, much like Steve Reeves, and yet now you no longer include such poses in your routine. Is there a reason for that? Yes, it's because it becomes necessary now to change a posing routine occasionally. Even next year, I'll change my poses, because you must pose for the audience and the judges. You must give them what they want. If they want to see a particular type of pose, you must do it, but with your own interpretation. Also, if you don't change your poses periodically, they begin to look old. It's best to try to come up with something new and fresh each time. Turning back to your training methods, do you have any bodybuilders in your gyms training the Serge Noubre way who will be champion soon? My outstanding pupils for the future are many, and several will be great champions. One, his name is Lambert, seems to have the greatest potential. He's very young and he's been training for only 3 years, but I'm sure he will be Mr. Universe in 2 or 3 years more of training. He has the best legs in Europe. He's good from the back, front, and side, and he's very cut up. As a final question, Serge, what are your goals for the future? I will travel to London tonight to try to win the professional Mr. Universe title, which he did. After that, I can continue hard training and competition for about 5 more years. And everything I do, I try to be the best. Bodybuilding is no exception. Watching Noubre train. We did have an opportunity to observe Serge Noubre training. As he said in the interview, he uses light weights. For benches, he was handling about 225, and for barbell curls, 100. He does his movements very fast cadence, and he rests only about 30 seconds between sets. We noticed he uses a very strict style with a complete range of motion. The day we watched, Noubre did chest, shoulders, arms, back, and calves. His exercises were for chest, bench press, incline barbell press, and narrow grip, stiff arm pullover. For deltoids, seated press behind the neck, upright rowing, and lying on the side laterals for the rear delt. For biceps, narrow grip barbell curls supersetted with benches and concentration curls. For triceps, lat pushdowns. For back, chins behind the neck, lat pulldowns behind the neck, and dumbbell rowing. For calves, calf machine, freehand stretching, and donkey calf work. We asked him for other body part favorites, and he gave us these exercises. Thighs, the hack slide machine, leg extension and leg curl, and for abs, incline sit-ups and incline leg raises. And there are some fantastic pictures of Serge Noubre training, and those pictures they took in Central Park are amazing. Serge Noubre at his best. He's incredible physique. Okay, I got Muscle Mag Annual. This was 2 years later. This was the Muscle Mag Annual 79. There's another article. This one's written by Robert Kennedy, the owner of Muscle Mag International. And it's called In the Gym with Serge Noubre. Serge Noubre was a bodybuilding sensation almost 20 years ago. He was well known in Europe and Scandinavia at this time, but a virtual unknown to the North American followers of her sport. Only in the last year or two has he really come into prominence, and even today there appears to be some reluctance to publicize him in certain quarters. For example, his part in the Pumping Iron film was minimized to such an extent to the uninitiated, that was hardly aware that he was in South Africa Mr. Olympia at all, least of all that he placed second to Arnold. Two, Noubre was asked by Ken Sprague to pose at last year's AAU Mr. America contest in Los Angeles, but because of personal differences between the Weider organization and Noubre, he was denied this right at the last minute. Also, the Noubre physique has been criticized greatly and possibly over severely. Among other things, it's been said that he doesn't have a back. Actually, Noubre's faults surround on the fact that his calves are a little on the light side, period. He has a phenomenal back. Look for yourself. Understand this. Noubre has the better natural shape than any of the champs, with the possible exception of Sergio Oliva. He has narrower hips than Arnold or Franco, bigger arms than Zane or Waller, better abs than Coe or Menser, and a harder overall appearance than Oliva or Robinson. Serge Dubre has a quiet dignity that makes him one of the most respected names in the bodybuilding field. He is educated, sophisticated, and possesses the noble, well-bred air of distinction. He lives in Paris, France, and his native tongue is French. He taught himself how to speak English during his travels to Britain and North America. My own thoughts on the 38-year-old Dubre run from ardent admiration to outright respect. He is good for the bodybuilding game. The man is always tastefully dressed, eloquent in speech, and dynamite on the posing platform. Originally from Guadeloupe, Serge has a great liking for fresh fruits and natural foods, but he also enjoys garbaging up now and then with a couple of plates of spaghetti. However, his training diet is built around large portions of meat or fish with an occasional wedge of lettuce. No other foods whatsoever. And as contest time approaches, even the lettuce is dropped and only the meats and fish are eaten, up to 7 pounds a day. My respect goes out to this man because he controls his emotions when others would let all hell loose. He lost a very disappointing and controversial decision in Dan Lory's Mr. Olympus in 1976. A soft-looking Sergio Oliva was given the title on reputation. Serge won the contest last year, but he did not have the satisfaction of going up against the Titanic Cuban again. The point is that Dubre did not throw a fit when he lost. He didn't sulk or walk off in disgust, and that is to his credit a thousandfold. He believes in letting the media make the grumbles on his behalf. At contest time, he merely offers a smile and a handshake to the winner, however embittered he may feel or however unjust he may feel the decision. It happened again. At the London Universe, though to be fair, Tony Emmett was not noticeably less developed. It's just that Dubre's shape, all other things being equal, as they were, probably should have been given the pro title. But Emmett was judged top man, and true to form, Dubre said not a word. He displayed no sour grapes, and by this action showed himself to be a gentleman of fiber and quality that few could be deservedly accredited with. It might also be noted that Emmett, too, is, win or lose, a great sportsman, and never shows anything other than good sportsmanship. The gym business seemed to be the most natural way to earn a living for Dubre, and he owns gym premises in Paris, Aesthetic Relaxed at 68 Boulevard de la Villette. He subsidizes his income by appearing in shows all over the world. As this is being written, he is due to appear in Australia, and he has already done several tours of North America and Canada. He is, of course, always in demand in continental Europe and the British Isles. Now in collaboration with his good friend Paco Arce, Serge Dubre has bought out a new French magazine called Muscle Flash. He has also formed WABA, the World Amateur Bodybuilding Association, his intention to run WABA contests throughout the world in direct competition to the IFBB, a somewhat larger organization created by the Weider Company many years ago. Paco is primarily a businessman, a thoroughly successful entrepreneur. He also is a photographer of no mean reputation, and he takes pictures for the various bodybuilding periodicals. Serge Dubre is married to a very attractive young lady, Jacqueline. He also has a daughter. His wife is studying to be a lawyer, and Serge manages to coax her into entering some of the various Miss contests. She always places high. One of the reasons why Dubre himself does so well in bodybuilding competition is that he pays attention to all aspects of preparation. He follows the correct training procedures, keeps to his diet totally during the last 6 weeks of pre-contest conditioning, always maintains a positive winning attitude, and he practices his posing presentations to the last detail. His posing trunks fit perfectly and complement his shape. He even sunbathes to give his skin a rich, even color. This is something most black men neglect. I'm particularly thinking of men like Joe Spooner and Sergio Oliva, who have sallow sunstar skins, which do not look their best under the posing lights. Rick Wayne, too, has this light skin, which benefits enormously from sunbathing. But then he knows the importance of sunbathing when in heavy training for a contest or photo session, and so it is with Dubre. For those of you who have doubts about the condition of Serge Dubre, we had one of the world's top photographers, Denny, shoot him at work in the gym. We consider them among the gems of present-day color physique photography. The end. And they do have some amazing photos in here by Denny. I thought there was going to be more in this article about Serge's training, but I guess not. But his diet is crazy. 6 pounds of meat and fish and no carbohydrates. That's unbelievable. Serge Dubre was one of a kind. And his training is really remarkable, too. that he was that big and he trained with lightweights all the time. And I've seen some photos of Serge training when he was younger. He trained very heavy, but it's amazing that he was able to build such muscle mass with such lightweights. But he trained very fast, 30 seconds rest in between, and tons of sets. Like you said, 45 sets of body parts. So crazy. So that is our show for this week, guys. I will keep working on our guest list. Frank Richard, Rick Wayne. I'm hoping to get Rick pretty soon. Phil Hill, I'm still working on him. I'm working on Tim Belknap, 1981 Mr. Olympia. He came out of the shadows. He's on Instagram now, so I've been talking to Tim. So keep your fingers crossed on that one. And Rick Poston, a great bodybuilder from Florida who competed in the 1983 Mr. America that Jeff King won. I've been talking to Rick as well. So we got a few people on the docket. Just got to get them committed to actually doing the interview. So we will do our best here at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Appreciate you guys listening to another show. Until next week, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.